Welcome to Living Above the Drama.
I'm your host, Dr. Georgiana Donatio, and today my guest is certainly a most interesting guest. He is a writer, editor, teacher, humorist, and performing artist based in New York City. But his memoir, American Misfit, which was released in 2017, tells the story of an American visiting Japan who was caught up in a terrifying arrest and imprisonment. When the U.S. Embassy informs him that there is nothing they can do to assist him, David's harrowing experience of enforced isolation, despair, and utter terror begins. David Kabatsky went through probably one of the most terrifying experiences any of us could go through, especially in a foreign land where you don't speak the language. David has worked professionally in theater and in circus as an actor, clown, and juggler at the New York City's Lincoln Center, Radio City Music Hall, and the Beacon Theater, and throughout the United States and Europe. He is the co-author and author of numerous books, including several books on cancer and the book Dear President Obama, Letters of Hope from Children Across America, and many other books. He is currently completing two memoirs and a short story collection and a revised version of Write for Life, all which will be published in 2019. David, I am delighted to have you on the show. I thoroughly enjoyed our pre-interview. It was illuminating. It was insightful, reflective, and terrifying all at the same time.
Thank you, Georgiana. It was really great speaking with you. You kind of poked into territory that I haven't really thought about in quite a while, and not in those ways. So it was illuminating for me as well.
Well, I'm happy. I'm happy that is is helpful to you. When we talked, you said that in 1987 you had two major traumas in your life, and one of them was that your dad died back in the States. You were in Japan at the time. Your father died of leukemia, which is blood cancer. And then in September of 1987, you were arrested and you ended up in a Tokyo jail. And we talked about how that experience, how you had no contact with anyone for 23 days at the beginning of your, being in jail. And everything that evolved past those 23 days. So I know I was terribly intrigued when I read the promo for you, which is why I wanted you to come on the show. And I'm sure the listeners want to know, we've all been through, we know that Midnight Express. We know about this poor American who wound up in Turkey for 5 years. And we know what happened to Otto Warmbier, that tragedy.
Gosh, yeah.
That horrible tragedy in North Korea. And you, fortunately, you're here and you're still breathing and healthy and functioning. So we know that you made it out. But would you please start us on your journey? As I said to you, when I read your book, your book starts off kind of surprisingly, because you had a knock at your door and you thought your mother might have been sending you some, cookies for the holidays, only to find out that it was quite something different. So why don't you take us on that journey? And if you wouldn't mind being detailed about it, because quite honestly,
sure.
it's really something. And I think we can all take away a great deal from it.
Yeah, well, it did begin on a Monday afternoon, about 3:30 or 4 o'clock. Mondays were usually a quiet down day for me, a rest day, after a lot of performing on the weekends with different kinds of engagements that I had, either in Tokyo itself, where I was living, or sometimes, out of the city. But the city was so big, and there's so much going on there that I had plenty of work right in the city. And this was performing stuff. So I would be doing any number of different things, depending on what I was hired to do, what kind of a gig it was. It could have been a juggling show. I had worked, you know, been working as a juggler at that point for several years, doing juggling and comedy, clown. I mean, really kind of people can assign different labels to it. There's a lot of shows where I'm improvising with the audience. These could be in theaters or open air situations, an amusement park, a library. They're also then doing street performing, where there were, you know, certain places in the city, and you can see this in cities all over the world, whether you see street musicians or magicians or jugglers or mimes. And I was one of those people performing. I had done it a lot in New York City, and there I was in Tokyo as well. So Mondays were a time to decompress and unwind physically, to rest, clean up, you know, your equipment and your props and costuming and things like that, get a little extra sleep, catch up on some phone calls. I was reading a book called The Demon Box by Ken Kesey, which I don't know if that was portending something bad happening at the door, but it was a pretty intense book, and Ken Kesey's been, you know, is always one of my favorite writers. So I was quite content to do that. At the same time, in the back of my mind, sometimes pushing into the forefront, by then it was a few months after my dad had died, and I was back in Japan after being home in America for a while, in the immediate days of that, and after the funeral and staying with my mom for a while to try to get her back on her feet and balanced, and also for me too. I wasn't really ready to jump back into the mix after that. Just the circumstances briefly. My father had been diagnosed with leukemia, and he essentially in the end went from what is normally a three-stage process that happened in that type of leukemia he had. He basically skipped from stage one to stage three, you know, and then it was very, very, very fast at the end. And I was literally trying to get a flight back from Japan earlier. I was planning to be there 2 weeks later, and there was a huge retirement party for him, and there were hundreds of people coming from all over. And my dad was a clergy. He worked his whole career as a cantor in the Jewish synagogue. So, and that was kind of the culmination of his whole career. And there was, you know, a closure on that. And his sickness was a fact of his life and ours. But we had no idea this was coming so quickly. So in June, you know, early June of that year, everything suddenly changed. And then here it was in the early fall, when I was back in Tokyo on this Monday afternoon, when a knock came on the door. And I did kind of jokingly think that my mother might have sent me some, you know, Rosh Hashanah cookies or something. or it was, you know, whatever. It was just the mail or something, you know, or yeah, nothing.
You had no foreboding. Right.
Yeah, no, not at all, not at all. It was just an innocuous knock on the door. It happened every once in a while. If your package would come or something like that. I lived in a small little traditional Japanese house, like a little dwelling. I think it might have originally been a single-family house, and it was two stories, and it was turned into four apartment units. And I had my very traditional, the sliding doors and the tatami mats. And I really loved it. It had a little tiny little balcony. It was lovely house in a very old traditional part of the city. That was quite a walk from the subway. You had to really navigate your way through it with all those landmarks, because there were very few street signs. So I was quite content and in my milieu, so to speak, on a Monday afternoon. And then boom, everything was radically turned upside down, let's say, with that knock on the door and about 10 or 12 stocking feet scurrying inside. This is all the police who were there in their not uniforms that we see, but I think they're more like undercover. They look like salarymen, the typical Japanese salarymen in their suits. You know, kind of like it's like wearing their cheap suits that they bought, like they bought them from the Japanese version of Sears or Kmart. You know, it's like it was kind of like a little dragnet. You know, You know, there was
But let me see, because this picture, I love this picture that you're painting because you're so creative. Here you are, probably barefoot, you know, going to the door, and you open it up, and there are these Japanese men who you can't identify right away as being policemen. So the terror, I mean, there's no terror at that moment. You open the door in there, but you don't know who they are, what they're doing, right? And could you talk to them? Could they talk to you?
It wasn't like they stood there and waited, you know, for some exchange of amenities.
They burst in.
As soon as I opened the door, they came right in. And I lived in a studio with a little kitchenette. And, you know, this, like I said, this is an old Japanese building, traditional wooden thing. I mean, my God, a little match, if you lit something the wrong way, the whole thing could have gone up. It's remarkable that these buildings even, like, lasted as long as they did. And my apartment studio was small, so if suddenly five or six people crowd into it, there's not a whole lot of room to stand all together, and it's not it's an invasion, no matter how you cut it, whether you know they're the police or you don't, or your brain shuts down because you kind of go into shock. At least that's what I call it now. At this moment, you don't know what it is. It's just that your brain starts to do weird things. And it also just sort of goes on hold to not evaluate or not either. That's partly denial. Definitely denial.
I'm sure.
If I don't have any, let's say, cognitive receptors working right now, then maybe it won't really be happening. If I don't try to even conceive or understand what's happening, then maybe that means it's not happening. But, you know, your brain can really play interesting games. And at the same time, you know, you feel almost that your breathing starts to shift, even though it's not like hyperventilating or anything obvious like that. It's almost like you have to, it just sort of almost slows down remarkably to a place that you don't even realize. And then at the same time, it starts kicking in and going way faster. So there's like two opposite, at least for me, this is what happened, was there were two opposing forces were working. One, you kind of realize, you think maybe what's going on, and you start to freak out, and the other part of you goes into a totally calm place that's so centered it's not even existing. And so it's a real kind of yin-yang and opposing forces that are happening. Meanwhile, these guys are scurrying around the apartment, and I hear them talking to each other, and then the main guy starts to talk to me, and this is a conversation I had never had in my life, much less in Japan, where I'm listening to erratic English, I would say. Probably wasn't as erratic as it might have seemed to me, but I was obviously going into some sort of panic mode that I didn't recognize, you know, because I'd never had anything like that.
Wow. The scene is set, and hopefully, because I know you have such a wonderful sense of humor, and I know that you really have brought your humor and your sense of irony to your experience to give it value and to look at it, you know, from kind of a more circular
I was so exasperated and almost angry, but in a way, like, really? It was kind of like, there's five or six of, what? On a Monday after, why is this even important enough that you guys, or whoever made this decision, that we're going to send a car full or two of people to this guy's place for nothing? For what?
Yeah, well, wait till we get to the for what, because that's, to me, that's a terrifying part. And I say that because, you know, you're a youngin', but I'm old enough to remember 40, 50 years ago when people would have what could only be called insignificant material on their person, in their possession, and they were thrown in jail for a year or two.
you know, for having a marijuana joint in their possession.
Oh, my God, yeah. I mean, even at that time, you know, when I lived, it hadn't been that long ago. This was 1987, and I believe it was 1982, 5 years earlier than that. I remember one incident when I was living in New York City, and I was performing on 42nd Street in a strip of the area called Theater Row, and it was a small little theater, and I became, you know, close friends with the guy who ran it. We used to do midnight shows there on Fridays and Saturdays, and then I was in a couple of plays there, and we were in Washington Square Park one day, just a random off day, kind of like another Monday afternoon, you know, after a full weekend of performing, and you're just kind of hanging out and just resting and regrouping on a Monday afternoon. Other people are working their 9-to-5 jobs, but I've, on my way, done like a triple dose of 9-to-5 over the weekend. So Monday's, just a calm day. And so we had nothing on the agenda. So we were in Washington Square Park. We were walking around. We sat down. We smoked a joint. And this was 1982 or something. So we were fully aware that it was illegal, technically, but it was like, we're living in New York City. We're in Washington Square Park. We're smoking a joint. Like, what's going to happen? We weren't afraid or anything, but a cop did come up to us, and he needed to show us how macho he was, so he took the joint and he put it down on the ground, and he ground his heel of his, you know, police shoes into it and looked at us just to show us how big and strong he was. He was sort of like the kid who would take your basketball in fifth grade recess or something because he was bigger and stronger than you and say, I can do this, I can be a bully. So this is a guy in uniform being a bully. He just still was the mentality of a fifth grader. But okay, nothing else happened. I think he wrote us a ticket. He actually wrote, I think I have that somewhere. I think I kept it. It's in a box of something somewhere, an actual ticket. And I don't even know I can't remember if we appeared or nothing happened, but it was never enforced or anything like that. And maybe because New York, which had a lot of crackdown on crime, but then it was also quite permissive in other ways. And, you know, growing up in the late 60s, 70s and being in college and around those times and all of that, that it was just, you know, wasn't a big deal. Even our president at the time, Jimmy Carter, 76 to 80, had spoken about the laws on minor drugs like that were way too draconian in the United States and they should be lessened. That was coming from the president of the United States. He was sort of an early advocate for, I don't remember if he actually couched it in the terms of legalizing marijuana, but certainly easing the laws on it and keeping things in perspective and saying, hey, come on, there are a lot more things important here in our domestic politics that we should be focusing on, not making people criminals because they're smoking a joint in Washington Square Park.
Yeah,
that kind of stuff. So that was the mentality that I grew up in, and that's what I had. Another time, like when I was in high school, the first time driving around with friends in high school, I had a joint, and I remember we got pulled over for no reason we even knew about. I think it might have been a taillight or something, and we were like scrambling in the front seat to put this, you know, oh my God, put the joint out, you know, like where's the ashtray, God, what's going, you know, blah, blah, blah. And then he gets us out, and he's we're up against the car, and he's frisking us, and we were giggling. It was just like we were in high school. We were smoking joint. It was a Sunday afternoon driving around, and it was just so innocent and a nothing burger, nothing burger before its time, we were just kids. It was like 1970, you know,
and today it's legal.
Well, yeah, today
it would be a non-issue.
Well, certain states are still back in, certain states, let's just say, are still existing in the 1940s and 50s, to say the least. But that's not only marijuana laws, that's, you know, all kinds of social and cultural issues where they're, you know, kind of living in the Stone Ages. But, so you got to be careful with that. I mean, that was also the time when people would say, if you're going to be driving down south with a New York City long hair, just expect as soon as you cross somewhere into the state of Virginia, you're going
to
get pulled over just because you have a New York plate and long hair.
So let's go back. I want to go back to, okay, they're in the house. They're in the
house. I'm just saying this is the back. Yeah. This is my experience with any issues with marijuana and legalities.
they're small, they're tiny, they're unimaginable, they're
right.
they're really just innocuous.
Right, so here you are. You're not thinking. I mean, you haven't done anything wrong. You know, and, you know, you haven't, you know, robbed anybody, hurt anybody, you know, accosted
anybody.
Oh,
no. I never was into drugs in any business way. No, not at all.
Right, but what I'm saying, you're in your studio, and you're not thinking anything. You know,
no.
You just... You know, it's your day off, and, you know, you've been working, and maybe your mother sent you some cookies, and you
I'm
don't
back
have
in
any...
my routine. I'm back in my routine in Japan. I was having pretty good success with my work. I had come to Japan without any real connections on a lark, just wanted to try something totally different. I had my two big fiber cases full of, my show equipment and costuming and props and all that stuff, and obviously some clothes and things. And I'd worked my way and made one connection led to another, and I was doing quite well, because at that time, too, it was a real curiosity to have an American performer doing the kind of work that I was doing. I was one of the first, in some places, the first one, doing that on his own without being brought over by an agency for a certain event. This is just like living there and working
right,
there.
Right.
I lived in several different neighborhoods, and this was one that I was really settled in, and I was seeing like a long-term thing. I developed relationships there. My Japanese wasn't anything to... to even say that I spoke it, that was like pretty ambitious. I speak Japanese. That's an ambitious way of saying that I could, you know, I could order food, I could find the bus station, I could, you know, because at that time nobody had GPS or anything like that. You actually had to ask people for directions.
David, I have to stop, because I can't believe it. I just looked at the clock. We have gone over the first break. This is so fascinating to me that I apologize. We went over the first break. We're going to take a very short commercial break. When we come back, we want to pick up on the story. There you are in your studio, hanging out. Five or six Japanese men in suits come into your apartment and start tearing it apart very methodically, but start tearing it apart, and you are arrested. So when we come back from the break, let's start with, did they put you in handcuffs or did they just walk you out?
Yes and yes. Yeah,
okay, they put you in handcuffs and they walk you out.
The whole
100 yards. Okay, so when we come back, we're going to start with that, and you're going to take us through what happened, which is really, I was terrified just listening to it. We'll be back in just a minute, everybody. Don't go away. We will be back with more David Tabatsky, American Misfit. I love the name of your book. Don't go away, anybody.
Are you tired of not feeling heard and not feeling valued? Are you longing to receive the love and respect you want? There is a solution right now. Transform your relationships with easy-to-learn, proven communication skills. Dr. Georgiana Donadio, relationship communication expert and number one national best-selling, award-winning author of Changing Behavior, explores the unconscious patterns contributing to stress, lack of fulfillment, and our relationship interactions. By learning and applying the simple principles of behavioral engagement, which has been clinically tested in leading hospitals, to develop mindful peer presence, you can experience the happiness and fulfillment you deserve in your relationships. Begin changing your behavior today with Living Above the Drama radio show host, Dr. Georgiana Donadio. Call 888-354-4325. 888-354-HEAL. Call now.
Become credentialed for the emerging medical health and wellness field. Work within healthcare environments or start your own private practice and bill for your services with your own NPI number. Train for this exciting specialty in patient-focused health and wellness education with the National Institute of Whole Health, NIWH, the only nationally accredited training program for patient health education and advocacy. Open to credentialed health and education professionals, our training qualifies for health educator liability insurance, a national provider identification number, and our expert-prepared billing and coding manual.
For more information about the National Institute of Whole Health, visit www.niwh.org or call 1-888-354-HEAL, 888-354-8255. 4325.
If someone said you could transform your life and enhance your relationships by using a few simple communication techniques that can be applied in almost any setting, would you want to learn these skills? If the answer is yes, you've picked up the right book. This easy-to-read guide is loaded with simple skills that have been scientifically shown to have a huge impact on our relationships. By using the steps in this book, you will be able to enhance not only your life, but the lives of everyone around you. If you have the intention to practice and apply these skills, it will become a natural part of who you are. A true must-read for anyone who wants to transform their professional and personal lives. Changing behavior. Immediately transform your relationships with easy-to-learn, proven communication skills by Georgiana Donadio.
You can purchase Changing Behavior by Dr. Georgiana Donadio by visiting Amazon.com, where it is available in both Kindle ebook and paperback.
Dr. Gass is on the advisory board of HealthCorp, a new program which was begun by Dr. Mehmet Oz.
65% are overweight and 35% are obese, and the sharpest rise in this country is between the age group of 4 to 8 years old.
Throughout his career, he has been inspired by patients who have experienced dramatic recoveries through lifestyle changes.
The National Institute of Whole Health is a perfect example of how people will learn to really take control of their lives in a healthy way. What they've done is they've collected basically the who's who of integrative health, and they've brought them together to give a series of lectures where they can then communicate with health professionals to basically deliver the message that we have to look at medicine from a different perspective.
For more information about the National Institute of Whole Health and their accredited professional continuing educational programs, go to www.wholepersonhealthcare.org or call 1-888-354-HEAL.
And we're back with David Tabatsky, who is the author of a really, really interesting, compelling book called American Misfit. And it's the story of his experience of being arrested and imprisoned in Japan. So, David, before the break, you're about to get handcuffed, okay? You're in the studio. They're tearing your place apart very, very methodically, very neatly, very organized. But and so, what happens from that point when they put the?
Well, I was taken finally after this whole long search of my apartment and being grilled and everything else, and it took quite a bit of time. It could have been a few hours. I was taken down to the street to this big, huge American car. I don't know, remember what kind of car it was, like a Chevy Impala or something like that. Like looked like it was out of the movie lot of Dragnet or some film, you know, or something. But there is a man sitting in there, and he must have been. I found out later he was sort of the head of the whole narcotics unit, and the central Tokyo narcotics unit. They're only the best, you know.
Yes.
we're going to spare no expense and personalities when we come after you, Mr. Tabatsky. So this guy looked like a Kojak impersonator. Honestly, he had the same size, the bald head, the hat, the way he dressed. It was like he had a Kojak obsession. Like people who live in other countries who really want to be like Americans that they see on TV. This guy, spitting image, it was remarkable.
Did he have the lollipop though? That's the question.
Yeah, exactly, the lollipop. But this also kind of made me laugh, but in a very bizarre way, because there was nothing funny about it. But you couldn't help but. I couldn't help but see it and wonder about it and go, and again, it was like, really? What weird surrealistic Fellini film am I in right now where I've got five or six guys b-
bust into my apartment. They all took their shoes off. They're scurrying around, going through all my stuff, but very politely. So they would rip something open, but then they would actually put it back, you know, together. It was like they were Lego experts or something. And it was just going around this whole thing. And it was like little battery, bunnies on the batteries, you know, and going around.
Energizer bunnies, yeah.
Yeah, that's what they were like. And then to be taken down the street with all these guys around me, scurrying me down the street into this car, and then we sat. I was in the back seat. There were two guys on my left and two guys on my right. It was a sizable back seat.
It was a big car.
It was an American style 80s car that was rather wide, but it was really packed. When you're the one person sitting in the middle of the back seat with two people on each side of you, and then two people or three people in the front, I don't remember. And then we were, driven to the main station, where I went through, hours of fingerprinting and all this other stuff, like all the things that you do when you get arrested. I guess it's just all the things that you see on TV in any country they actually do. I don't know what would have been the difference. I've never been arrested in the United States, so I had nothing really to compare it to, other than, like most people, what you've seen on television. And so that's really what you compare your real life arrest to now, is a bunch of TV shows. So it's rather sad and maybe unrealistic, and you don't know, and you're going, wow, does this really happen? Is this the way they do it in the States? It's like, what am I, but it was just very, very surreal, very bizarre. It took a long time. It wasn't until like 10:30 at night that I was taken from there. You know, this started like at 3:30 in the afternoon in my apartment until 10:30 at night, when I was taken to an actual jail and put into a jail cell. When it was like pitch dark. It was like totally black in there. There was no windows or nothing. There was a central guard, but I don't remember there being any light on his station there. I'm sure if it was a reason, they would have turned the lights on, but it was like lights out. The other prisoners who were in their cells were already sleeping. And so then they brought me in. So when I used the bathroom and flushed the toilet, I remember it was a big hubbub. Everybody was pissed off because I woke them up, because I didn't know. Like, you're not supposed to do that.
So here you are. So
hold it in all night and don't.
We're having much too much fun talking about this. Let's. And that's because I have.
Because it was much too much fun to live it.
I know.
Let's just make that distinction.
I know. You have such an incredible attitude. I mean, I've worked a lot with patients who've had, post-traumatic syndrome and have really had terrible trauma. And what you went through was really traumatic.
I think I've had my share of that. And like I was telling you before, I hit some very dark, scary places in my psyche during this time, not knowing what was going on, being intimidated by other prisoners, guards, even the American Embassy, a man who came several days in, came by, I guess I think they have to inform the embassy when there's an American citizen who is being held. I think it's a legal thing through, country-to-country agreements. And so he came just as part of his job, showed up, brought me a Time magazine, I think, from like 8 months earlier that was probably sitting around the embassy somewhere. They took it away. I wasn't even allowed to look at it. And then he told me, be careful, don't incite any of the guards, because they're known to be well-trained in martial arts. And if they punch you in the stomach, you can have an internal organ can explode, but there will be no external signs, so they won't be liable, and you'll be in great danger or dead. So that's pretty much what he said. He, instead of riding in on a white horse and rescuing me, he said, don't be a wise ass, or you could get killed. That was pretty much the upshot of all of that. So that was rather charming. So you really were. I was radically on my own. Wasn't allowed to make a phone call. Wasn't allowed to notify anyone through any system at all. The man from the American Embassy said he couldn't. He's allowed to do one thing. I gave him. He wrote down the number of my sister, who lived in San Francisco, and so he was able to reach her because I didn't want my mother to get a phone call from the American Embassy, and after having lost her husband just a few months earlier, for her to get the phone call telling them that I had been arrested. I wanted that information to come from my sister, so at least it was her own daughter was telling her all this, you know, crazy bad news. So that was the most humane way I could arrange for that to happen, and luckily he did that.
Well, you know, so here you are, because now this is where I start to get scared, right? What happens is the guy from the embassy says, sorry, can't help you, kid. You're on your own, you know.
Yes.
No white horse, no white hat. You know, you're with the bad guys.
Yeah, and there's no John Wayne. There's
no John Wayne. Band. Nobody's coming in. It's not like the movies, right?
Oh,
and
God.
You are now really worried and concerned because they're isolating you. And they're limiting you having any communication or connection.
Well, I was
with
first upset. The thing that had upset me for several hours was I was supposed to meet at the end of the afternoon, like about an hour later, I was going to leave my apartment and go meet my agent, my talent agent, who's also had become quite a good friend of mine. And I write about Igarashi in the book. I could have dedicated the book to him. I just really get hit so emotional now, even like to recollect him. He's really one of the most meaningful friends I've had in my life. And so I was so upset that there's no way for me to let Igarashi know that I wasn't going to make it to his office, because we're just going to discuss some things and then probably go have a meal or something like that, a typical thing we would do at the end of a Monday. So I was really upset that I had no way to contact him. They wouldn't allow me to do that. I kept asking, and I knew that it was futile, but I had to keep asking. That's what was really bugging me, was that immediate thing. And then the following night, I had a gig in a jazz club, and I was going to leave them, not knowing what was going on, and Igarashi, who had set up the gig, it was going to be, you know, egg on his face. And those are the things immediately that I felt so bad about, because that's something totally out of character for me, like to not show up for a gig or to not communicate. And that's why he told me later, he said, I knew something was radically wrong, because this is 100% not you, that you would, you know, just flake off or not show up or not call
right,
me or
right.
do anything.
Yeah.
So that was totally 100% out of character on a personal level and a professional level. So, yeah, that was really what was bugging me a lot the whole time, because I still didn't really understand the gravity of the situation. All I knew was I was being held, and there was a three-day initial thing. Finally, it sunk into me. I knew that when I got put in that jail, okay, I'll be out in 3 days, you know, because there's no way they can keep me here. What they found in my apartment was less than a gram of hashish, less than 1 gram of hashish. You could put that, you could stick that in your nose and not even know it's in there, you know.
Right. I love it. You described it as a booger of hash. That's what you.
It is. It's like a booger. It would be like you know, sometimes you something's like, oh, you feel
something
in your nose.
Something in your nose. Yeah.
You turn away when nobody's looking, and you,
right.
you put your finger in there, and it's like, oh, okay, boom, and that's gone. Oh, okay, that's what was itching, you know. And that's really what it would have been. That's exactly the same size, and that's what I was like, what is going on there? This whole thing coming because of that this can't be true. It just can't be true. Like, and this is before there was like MTV was it MTV that had this show called Punk? That was like a couple of decades later.
Oh, Punk. So, yeah.
And I thought about that many years later, but it wasn't like that, because, you know, nobody was pranking me. And even if they were, nobody can pull off a prank like this with real police and real jail cells and all this stuff. It's like, no. I don't have friends who are going to go to that extreme, even if it was possible. So then
I was in for those 3 days, and then thinking, okay, it's all going to end. Like, I don't even, they don't even use lawyers or nothing. It's just going to, it's
right.
in the system, and I'm going to, they'll say, okay.
Right.
Really
so your expectation is this is just a little bump in the road. This is a bleep, and I'm going to get out of here. It's all going to work out.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I felt terrible because I had left Igarashi in the cold and not been there for the opening night of this new gig in this jazz club, which was right in a great neighborhood and in a really cool place, and I was going to be the first like non-jazz musician to perform in there, and it was like a small big deal, you know,
right,
you could call
right.
it that. And so that was gone. I was like, oh man, I was just so wiped out just from that, and also wondering what my sister, how is my sister going to get this news? Is she going to? Mm-hmm. No, this was before. No. My sister hadn't even been contacted. This was in the first 3 days. I hadn't met yet the guy from the American Embassy. None of that had happened. I was totally on my own, not able to communicate with not a single.
Right.
Person.
So, but at this point, a couple of days in, you're going, it's going to work out. You know, this is, it's creepy, it's frightening, it's annoying, it's frustrating, it's enraging, but you're not really starting to get some psychological stuff. Now, we have to take another break, believe it or not, and when we come back, we've got all of that 10 to 12 minutes left. So what we want to, I really want to jump into, what happened to you? And what is it like as an American being overseas and finding yourself, you know, basically the equivalent of a traffic ticket and being incarcerated as you were? Don't go away, anybody. We will be right back. And, you know, the story's building. David's going to tell us about, he's got the best line. The best line in the world is, please waterboard me now so I don't have to be isolated. And I don't mean to make that funny, but David, when you said that, it was hysterical. We will be back with David, so don't go anywhere.
Dr. Gass is on the advisory board of HealthCorp, a new program which was begun by Dr. Mehmet Oz.
65% are overweight and 35% are obese, and the sharpest rise in this country is between the age group of 4 to 8 years old.
Throughout his career, he has been inspired by patients who have experienced dramatic recoveries through lifestyle changes.
The National Institute of Whole Health is a perfect example of how people will learn to really take control of their lives in a healthy way.
What they've done is they've collected basically the who's who of integrative health, and they've brought them together to give a series of lectures where they can then communicate with health professionals to basically deliver the message that we have to look at medicine from a different perspective.
For more information about the National Institute of Whole Health and their accredited professional continuing educational programs, go to www.wholepersonhealthcare.org or call 1-888-354-HEAL.
If someone said you could transform your life and enhance your relationships by using a few simple communication techniques that can be applied in almost any setting, would you want to learn these skills? If the answer is yes, you've picked up the right book. This easy-to-read guide is loaded with simple skills that have been scientifically shown to have a huge impact on our relationships. By using the steps in this book, you will be able to enhance not only your life, but the lives of everyone around you. If you have the intention to practice and apply these skills, it will become a natural part of who you are. A true must-read for anyone who wants to transform their professional and personal lives. Changing behavior. Immediately transform your relationships with easy-to-learn, proven communication skills by Georgiana Donadio.
You can purchase Changing Behavior by Dr. Georgiana Donadio by visiting Amazon.com, where it is available in both Kindle ebook and paperback.
Are you tired of not feeling heard and not feeling valued? Are you longing to receive the love and respect you want? There is a solution right now. Transform your relationships with easy-to-learn, proven communication skills. Dr. Georgiana Donadio, relationship communication expert and number one national best-selling, award-winning author of Changing Behavior, explores the unconscious patterns contributing to stress, lack of fulfillment, and our relationship interactions. By learning and applying the simple principles of behavioral engagement, which has been clinically tested in leading hospitals, to develop mindful, pure presence. You can experience the happiness and fulfillment you deserve in your relationships. Begin changing your behavior today with Living Above the Drama radio show host, Dr. Georgiana Donadio. Call 888-354-4325. 888-354-HEAL. Call now.
Become credentialed for the emerging medical health and wellness field. Work within healthcare environments or start your own private practice and bill for your services with your own NPI number. Train for this exciting specialty in patient-focused health and wellness education with the National Institute of Whole Health, NIWH, the only nationally accredited training program for patient health education and advocacy. Open to credentialed health and education professionals, our training qualifies for health educator liability insurance, a national provider identification number, and our expert-prepared billing and coding manual.
For more information about the National Institute of Whole Health, visit www.niwh.org or call 1-888-354-HEAL, 888-354-4325.
Talking with David Tabatsky, who is the author of an amazing book called American Misfit, which tells of his misadventure, if you will, as an American in Japan who is arrested for truly what today is the equivalent of a a big parking ticket, and what he goes through, the ordeal and the terror, and you know, the unfortunate trauma that befalls him. So, David, let's jump right in. And you really did say to me, would you please waterboard me now so I don't feel so isolated? I mean, you became isolated. Isn't that what they did to you?
Well, yes. Initially, I was in a cell with three other people. One had been he spoke a little bit of English, and enough between my Japanese and his English, he explained to me that he was in for gambling thing. He was in this whole network of gambling, underground gambling in Tokyo. So he was sort of like shrugging his shoulders, like he'd been in like 5 or 10 times. He was a return, prisoner. It was not a big deal to him. He was just sort of going to wait it out and go back and do what he did again. Another guy, young guy, who was pretty tough, constantly doing push-ups and sit-ups and then looking at me like I was supposed to be impressed. He had robbed a 7-Eleven, so he was in, and then I can't remember what the third guy was. He didn't talk too much. He growled a lot, and so, but it was weird because then, when dinner would come, they would shove the food in through this screen of the door, and then with a little, tablecloth, yeah, like what was supposed to be like a little tablecloth, only everybody's sitting on the floor. But they were quite conscious of, hygiene, like you shouldn't eat right on the floor of the cell. You put down this little thing, so it was sort of like this very almost jovial, friendly little ceremony of spreading out the tablecloth among the four of us, and then eating our very extremely mediocre, cheap Japanese food for dinner.
But when did that end? Okay, let's get to the point. I want to get to the point.
Well, there was a three-day point. Try to do this in the most concise way I can. So at the end of 3 days, I was taken and driven in a prison bus across Tokyo to the jailhouse and gone in the back way. Like, this is the part you never see from the front of the building, even in America, through the bottom, through the tunnels, into the bowels of the courthouse, where you're put in these waiting cells and you're handcuffed and you're strung together with other prisoners through your feet and your legs. They're not shackles, but they're shackley, let's say, so then you wait and you wait and you wait for hours and hours, then finally you go up and you see the prosecutor, and the prosecutor kind of looks at you and then rubber stamps, and boom, 10 more days. That was it. There was no discussion, no explanation, nothing. I was just like, 3 days, nope, we're going to do 10 more days of investigation. I was like, what? There's nothing to investigate. There's literally, there was nothing more,
how many more questions could they ask? There's just no more information to give. I have to make stuff up, and then I'm thinking, oh my God, I have to make stuff up, because if I don't answer the questions, they think I'm resisting. So now I have to really be careful what I make up, because then when they ask me again, because they probably will, I have to say the same things. Otherwise, I'm going to be stepping into my own lies, and then that's going to really compound it. But I'm in a catch-22. Like, I have to give them answers, but I don't have any more answers to give because there is no story.
Right. How long did that whole cycle?
I went 10 more days. That's 13 days. And then at the end of the 10 days, they're legally allowed to keep me 10 more. And meanwhile, no phone calls, no contact with lawyers, no contact with friends, total isolation. And then at a certain point, I think it was in the first week, they moved me out of that cell and put me in my own cell by myself. And so when I wasn't taken to the narcotics office for hours at a time for this weird, surrealistic interrogation, I was alone in my cell with no way, no windows, no nothing, nothing to read, nothing to do, nothing to write with, nothing, you know, no communication, nothing. So that started to get to me. My brain started to do some unprecedented things, probably, and even chemically, you know, with the lack of sleep, with the anxiety rising, with the sense that I did not know what was going to happen from one minute to the next. Like when a prison guard would come, you know, step to my door and you know, get me ready, I didn't know what they were taking me to. I mean, there were certain things that kept repeating itself, but from one day to the next, I didn't necessarily know that. Nobody explained anything to me.
So you were really living in the dark for a long time in terms of knowing what was going on, knowing what your fate was, knowing who these, you know, people were that were moving you around and what it meant. And I think one of the things that you talked about is that you were threatened with physical harm, but it wasn't done, but you were threatened with it. So on top of that, you had this constant, you know, kind of
thrown out of an office. I was taken one night when I had trouble sleeping every night, but then one night I was just ranting and raving a little bit in my cell, and just some casual ranting and raving.
I have to tell you, you make this really. You should be doing a comedy thing about this. I mean, it's not funny, but you have such a great attitude and such a sense of humor. So you're ranting and raving incoherently.
I was taken to. Well, I didn't even know the prison had a doctor on staff because I'd never met him. But maybe he wasn't always there. But I was taken to this basement room or something, some other floor. And it was this weird little office where apparently this guy, they told me he's a doctor. I didn't see any evidence of it, but okay. What else am I supposed to do? So he wanted to give me sleeping medication, and I flipped out because it's like you're arresting me for drugs, and now you want to give me more drugs. I was out. I was just beyond, you know, acting reasonable, and knew that, but I couldn't stop it too. I was like, come on. I was like, I knew. Part of me was going, you're being so infantile. Just, you got to suck it up and just, you know, lay in your cell. If you don't sleep, don't sleep. But don't. What are you doing with these people? But I couldn't help it, and I was also so pissed. I was just playing. I mean, there was this anger. Like this wasn't just some bad luck for a few days anymore. This was now, you know, stretching towards. It was my second, you know, first or second 10-day extension, and that this was like, okay, this is not cool. This is way beyond, you know, here. So the guy, he pushed me, he got up, he got pissed. I don't know, just my whole attitude and everything. And I was really laying it into him because it was also, I was speaking in English really fast, thinking he's not going to understand me. And I was calling him every name in the book. I mean, this was really like, it was rancid what was coming out of my mouth. And I guess he understood a little bit more than I realized because he just got up. He pushed me. I went flying. I went like 8-10 feet out into the hallway and landed on my butt. And at the feet of a police officer I looked up at, he just kind of looked down at me like, you know, we could keep this going or you could just shut up and go back to your cell. And which is what I did because what were my options? And I, you know, so I didn't take the medicine, and then another night I finally did because it made me pass out. But I was like groggy and in terrible shape the next day all day, which is it's bad enough to be in prison, but then when you feel chemically altered all day long, it's even worse. And so that happened, and at the end of the 23 days, I was officially indicted because they have to either let you go or the prosecutor indicts you. So this was another repeat trip to the courthouse and going through a whole long thing, and then the prosecutor with his tiny little beady eyes, I'll never forget this, what did this guy look like, who then basically just said one thing and literally rubber stamped my paperwork and sent me off.
I have to tell you, we've got about 2 minutes, maybe three left. Oh my God! So from there,
I went to what was it like the equivalent of a federal prison for a while longer before I went to trial, and I'll leave it there at what happened with my trial.
Well, we can't leave it there because you ultimately.
Well, I'm not in Japan now speaking to you long distance from prison, 30 years later, which is, I don't think I might not have this tone of voice and lightheartedness. Yeah, I think I would,
So the bad news is you spent almost 2 months in Japan detained and terrified and really traumatized for what was really a minor, never given an explanation as to why they, came after you, how they found you, what that was all about.
Well, there is more explanation, but to be very honest, that's something that I would hope that readers will say, hey, this story is compelling, and hopefully if it's engaging the way it sounds like, I want to read it, and then I'll find out a little bit more about what some of the background information was.
Great. Okay, so listeners, if you want to know some of the why they came after David and how that whole thing evolved, you can read his book, American Misfit. The title is just brilliant. And so ultimately, you went through a very hard time, and we talked about like what were the bullet points, and there were three things that I made a note in the pre-interview that we talked about, and one of them was what terror feels like, because you also talk about the Japanese mafia gangs, the Asuka, and we didn't even get to that about
Yakuza. When I was brought into the big the state prison, and there's all this whole processing there where they strip everybody naked,
and you were with these gang members.
I was in a room alone with 10 or 12 guys in full body tattoos, with some of them missing fingers and that they cut off, and stuff like that.
Right, so you went through all of that, and it was terrifying, and so you found out what terror was like. You also said that the challenge, the lesson is to learn that we can handle more than we think. So
yes,
you
but they never
that,
kept in touch. Like that was the other thing. The Yakuza, I reach out to them, every year for Christmas. they never call back.
There you go. And the other thing that we talked about is that solitary confinement is the cruelest thing that you can do to a human being, and we know that psychologically.
Wow, yeah. I mean, when you think, when somebody says colloquially, oh, I lost my mind, or oh my God, I'm flipping out, I think I'm going to go crazy, I'm like, now I know what that actually is, because you really get into some dark, scary places where you are across, you kind of cross this line where you don't really can't confidently say I have control of my emotional existence and my psychology right now.
And your reality gets really skewed. So the moral of this story for me is, apart from don't travel. No, I'm kidding. The moral of this story is that we realize how precious our freedom is, number one. Number two, how important our connections, our relationships are, and how interdependent we are as human beings. And I think that's a beautiful thing. And David, I just want to thank you coming on here, sharing your story. It's a mind blower. People, go get the book. I mean, there was so much. David and I talked for about an hour and a half the other day, and there's so much to know about this. And we kind of, really didn't get into all the nooks and crannies, like that you were sitting in the exact same chair being interrogated that Paul McCartney had sat in, all kinds of stuff. So
that was a very odd twist. And the narcotics officer, the head of that department, who kept interrogating me, he had kind of an odd smile. He was almost proud and fascinated by it. At the same time, he was all business. So it was
a strange thing. David, thank you so much. We so appreciate having you. It's a great book, American Misfit. Go get it and enjoy it. I love the style of writing. It'll really pull you in. Thank you, David, and I hope we get a chance to talk again soon.
Yes, thanks so much, Georgiana. Thank you.
Listeners, don't forget to join me again next week for another very informative, entertaining, and educational program here on Living Above the Drama.